crimes against smuggling money and decolonization in East Africa. It's an historical ethnography of economic sovereignty in East Africa, tracing the ends of empire, the pursuit of economic self-determination, and the eventual pluralization of value. So today's talk looks at what I think of as the kind of last topic, the kind of fracturing and reorientation of value production, circulation, and appropriation. So in contrast to a sort of 1950s, 1960s effort to remake the economy through national banks and national currencies, through sovereign debt and parastatal organizations, the 1970s revealed the heterogeneity of ideas about how value should be made and governed. So in response, East African states tried ever more desperately, sometimes coercively, to produce and corral economic citizens. In the face of what they deemed hoarding, smuggling, and overcharging, states like Uganda convened economic crimes tribunals that punished popular practices. So this talk examines the dynamics of such crimes against economy, both in the juridical exercises, but also the kind of social and ethical quandaries for those participating. I'll aim to speak for around 45 minutes, and I hope we can have a kind of conversation afterwards to the extent that Zoom permits. So on April 21st, 1976, officers Okuchu and Ekuma left the police station to walk the streets of Jinja, Uganda's second most important commercial town. Purposefully slipped into Okuchu's pocket was a 10-shilling note with the serial number A29334493. Dressed in plain clothes, they poked their heads into shops, inquiring as to supplies and prices, seemingly innocuous customers hankering for a deal. At a shop staffed by a young woman, Harriet Bieri, they found the sort of deal they hoped for, handing over their 10-shilling note for what the court later learned was 450 grams of unsliced white bread. The officers departed the shop, only to return a moment later to arrest the cashier. Carefully retrieving their money from the till, they hauled the young offender and the unsliced loaf off the jail. Miss Bieri's case would be heard 2 months later in front of the Economic Crimes Tribunal. Confronted with the testimony of the officers, there was little she could do beside plead guilty to the crime of overcharging for a controlled commodity. Instead of the legally prescribed price of 3 shillings and 40 pence, Bieri partook in what at the time was a commonplace but illegal act of exchange. A presidential decree in 1975 established the Economic Crimes Tribunal, tasked with policing hoarding, overcharging, and smuggling. Such crimes were punishable by death, and across Uganda, thousands were hauled before the special courts, confronted by cameras, crowds, and evidence of their improper market behavior. For Major Arafazi, the chairman of the Economic Crimes Tribunal sitting that day in Jinja, justice would not be met by a mere declaration of guilt. Instead, it required adjourning the court and marching with those gathered to the store a few blocks away. There, the crowd confronted Mrs. Batambuzi, the owner, whose absence on the day of the crime saved her from conviction. It did not, however, mean that she walked away from the sting operation unscathed. Her pleas for mercy held little sway for Major Arafazi, who ordered the property seized, the doors locked, and the trading license canceled. As for the 10 shillings, the court returned it to the police, and the bread was officially ordered to be destroyed. Now, at first blush, the category of economic crimes might strike a kind of discordant tone. After all, in the common law tradition, it's usual to think of commercial matters being the realm of private law, the subject of torts, contracts, and property, while it's matters of public concern, those that offend the general interest in their seriousness, that fall under the jurisdiction of criminal law. Yet post-colonial states from India to Uganda, Tanzania to Ghana, and beyond made economic behavior not the subject of civil law alone. Rather, it became the object of official scrutiny, driven by the urgent efforts to determine how value was made and controlled. Through marketing boards, loan schemes, and a new national currency, Uganda tried to remake an imperial economy, turning it into an object of sovereign authority. And so this is a talk as an effort to bring the kind of anthropology of sovereignty into conversation with an anthropology of value through the notion of economic sovereignty. I think the notion of economic sovereignty has been overlooked in our disciplinary focus on the anthropology of violence, as well as the anthropology of development. So how should we think about economic sovereignty? In the case at hand, economic sovereignty involved an effort to govern the territorial remit of value, its temporality, and the standards by which it was measured. So consider an example, rather mundane one repeated innumerable times across Uganda and the rest of the continent. Coffee and cotton smallholders putting their produce on a scale and receiving a cash payment in return. So the sale of these crops provided domestic income, and the eventual export provided the overwhelming majority of state revenue. Like the colonial state, Uganda closely regulated these transactions, defining where export crops could be sold, the window of time in which they must be sold, and the price per kilo. So carrying coffee beans to Zaire, or drying and storing them for a better price next year, or selling by volume rather than weight, all of these were proscribed. The state, in other words, governed the geography of value, its temporality of accrual, and its measurement. Economic crimes map on to these concerns. So in the threefold of smuggling, hoarding, and overcharging, we can see the same concerns about the space of economic circulation, its temporality, and the measurement of value. To be more precise, smuggling criminalized long-standing circuits of cross-border trade in East Africa. Hoarding named the illicit immobilization of goods against the state's demanded rhythm of trade, and overcharging signals a demand that goods be measured according to official dictate, such as 3 shillings and 40 pence for 450 grams of unsliced white bread. Economic crimes, Rohit Day has suggested in an analysis of post-colonial India, represent a sort of permanent state of emergency that authorized draconian force against a populace that diverged from state prescriptions. A state of emergency, however, represents the thinnest veneer of sovereign authority. Rather than ruling through what Weber called a constellation of interests, the situation by the 1970s was more akin to Ranjit Guha's notion of domination without hegemony. The Ugandan state lacked the symbolic power to reshape economic practices and instead relied on more overtly coercive tactics, including sting operations, public trials, and penalties up to death for these economic crimes. What I'd like to focus on is less the contours of economic sovereignty, though it's an important backstory. Rather, I'd like to offer a kind of historical ethnography of the sorts of subjectivities, the relations that are animated by the weakening of economic sovereignty in the 1970s, the types of practical norms between people and things that emerged as the state's claims fractured under the weight of divergent notions of how value was to be pursued. Now, an accusation of economic criminality was serious business, opening one to extreme vulnerability to state violence. For the accused, establishing their virtue was therefore pressing. Consider the case of Jonathan Mukasa, a shop owner and transporter in Jinja who was arrested in mid-September 1973 with 200 tins of cooking oil illegally in his shop overnight. So writing to the Minister of Commerce and Industry with copies sent to everyone from Idi Amin to the district police commander and beyond, Mukasa explained in detail how the tins were only in his shop because his truck had broken down and needed to be winched up for repairs. He was no hoarder, he insisted, pointing to 2 years of service for the State Trading Corporation and other clients. I strongly support the government in punishing hoarders of commodities and those who overcharge, he wrote. The basis of our government is God, and God is just, so I hope that justice in this matter will prevail. Now, Mukasa's case points to the uncertain ontology of a hoard. When's something a hoard, and when is it not? Is it the status of goods being in motion that absolves the heinous act of criminal containment? Or since everything will be stationary at some point, should we look to the intention for which a commodity is not circulated? For Mukasa, this was the crux of the matter. As his truck was being repaired, there was no intention to remove goods from circuits of exchange. But this wasn't an arena of elaborate jurisprudence or clear definitions. So as a result, the accused adopted a range of idioms to rehabilitate themselves. One of the most common was an explicit discourse of economic citizenship, the dynamics of which I'd like to discuss for a moment. It seems to me that like economic crimes, the dynamics of economic citizenship have been occluded by a bifurcation of the economic and the political. So influential theorists of citizenship foreground the cultural dimensions of collectivity and legal recognition of belonging. Yet mid-century Ugandans were deeply concerned with citizenship as a means of redistribution. Independence was not merely about the achievement of long-denied rights of representation and self-government. Decolonization was also envisioned as a means to commercial liberties. And to do so, many looked to the state to remake regulatory regimes that blocked African opportunity and also to provide financial resources and training. Economic citizenship was a racialized phenomenon. The British colonial state had relied on South Asian immigrants to serve as commercial middlemen in East Africa. In addition to operating the small shops from which Africans purchased most commodities and a number of substantial industries, South Asians were also responsible for buying much of the export crops from African farmers. African farmers bitterly complained of underhanded dealings, low prices, and their exclusion from this crop brokerage business. The expulsion of South Asians by Idi Amin's government in August 1972 was therefore greeted with considerable enthusiasm by many. So for instance, on August 8th, 1972, the self-described natives of the land, Ugandan traders of Busoga district, wrote an exuberant letter to Idi Amin. "You promised action, and so also action we promise in return. Relieve us," they beseeched, "from the evils of exploitation and trade, preserve us in commerce and industry, and deliver us into the fruits of independence and everlasting prosperity." So not merely solicitous, not merely in this kind of Christian idiom, the traders offered pages of advice on how to further the indigenization of the economy, from training in business plans to rent controls and preferential access to government tenders. In this genre of rhetoric, the nation state had both the capacity and the duty to provide economic opportunity to a citizenry that was properly conceived as autochthonously African. The racialization of South Asians was animated by their putative economic behavior. In the view of such critics, South Asian economic returns circulated both too narrowly and too widely. It was too narrow because profits remained within racial, even familial circuits. So, quote, "They live together, they play together, they do not speak our languages," wrote these petitioners. "Deals were done among only their own relatives, Indian for Indian, only thus retaining the entire industry in one large or small family." But these exclusionary networks were also too expansive, escaping the borders of the country. So all these so-called citizens have a home elsewhere, but they remain in Uganda to receive their undue deserts. Even those who died in Uganda showed their alien allegiances, according to these petitioners, by having their ashes returned back home and not thrown in the River Nile. So for these petitioners, the cross-border family firm of South Asians and the ritual performances that accompanied diasporic belonging, they invalidated their standing as economic citizens of Uganda. As the 1970s progressed, more and more of the economy was officially controlled by the government. The result was an active back and forth between citizens and state over the nature of economic citizenship. This was not only about the threefold concerns I outlined above, the geography, temporality, and measurement of value, but it was also about personal decorum, urban cleanliness, and much more. And in the process, it was impossible to imagine the economic as distinct from the political. Rather than an autonomous domain, Idi Amin thoroughly politicized production and exchange in his declaration of an economic war. This involved a range of demands, from doubling agricultural production to requiring the clear display of price tags for customers. Cyclists were to stay off the sidewalk so as not to inconvenience shoppers. Customers were to be treated with courtesy, and receipts needed to be issued for every sale. Only through such remaking of behavior and the deployment of such mundane technologies would Uganda win this economic war. The state placed an increasing burden of demands on economic citizens, and the exhortations were severe, such as the words of the provincial governor for Busoga when speaking to licensed traders in January 1976. "It is with disappointment that I address you today," he opened. "Your wrongdoings are disturbing the peace of everybody. And instead of serving the people through the proper sale of cement, iron sheets, and beverages, you businessmen milk your fellow Ugandans by overcharging and hoarding." Such malfeasance in the eyes of the governor did not merely justify revoking their license to do business. It threw into question their citizenship, even their very identity. These economic crimes, he said, show that you are the true enemies of Uganda and are by virtue of this foreigners who have been forced to stay here. You seem to be African Indians in Uganda. The behavior, he suggested with a hint of shame in his fellow citizens, made people question whether they were incapable of sustaining their own country. In these years, such existential questions became more and more common. From the perspective of officialdom, the very reproduction of the state was in question. As production waned and exports fell, illegal trade subverted the tax base, and the maintenance of the state became an increasingly difficult task. Our task is noble, said the Minister of Agriculture when speaking to farmers. We must succeed in earning Uganda foreign exchange. Yet in response to the duties placed on them, many citizens made claims upon the government for its unmet responsibilities. Unsatisfied with the availability of essential commodities and protesting price increases, some citizens attacked police. Dissatisfaction in other cases was directed at the distribution agents. Others protested magistrates who were being bribed with goats, pig, money, and even cows. Throughout the period, there's a frequent invocation of this idiom of economic citizenship, with Ugandans justifying their access to commodities on the basis of their national belonging and their ability to contribute to the advancement of the country as a whole. So while some composed letters to the president and others protested, accused, and attacked, there were other repertoires available. In the next part of this talk, I'd like to spend a bit more time excavating these sorts of activities that were criminalized during the period. In the opening, I suggested that the Ugandan state, like others, sought to acquire a monopoly on valuation of key crops and commodities. By the mid-1970s, this regime of valuation was undercut by a massive smuggling trade. Coffee and cotton poured out the seams of the country, much of it across the border with Kenya, where it made its way to Mombasa and then Euro-American consumers. Fundamental to this trade, known as magendo, were cross-border ties of kinship, ritual, and language. The people called Babukusu in Kenya and Bagisu in Uganda share a long history and a cultural infrastructure that facilitated the smuggling. So consider the trajectory of Josiah, a Ugandan man with a reputation as being one of the earliest participants in this coffee trade. He was able to get in on the business because he was already working with a relative of his, a prominent man in Kenya. In the mid-1970s, he began bringing Ugandan coffee to Kenya to fetch a better price, setting up a shop on the Kenya side with a relative of his there. There, he bought coffee from Uganda and sold soap, sugar, and other commodities to Ugandans who couldn't find it at home. Josiah was ambitious. He was unsatisfied with being a mere middleman. And so he bought trucks to ferry coffee to Nairobi and Mombasa. He was particularly successful buying land and educating his children, because he was closely embedded in the networks of kin and culture at the border, but he was also able to form more distant commercial relations. This was evident when Ugandan soldiers crossed the border in the middle of the night, ransacking his store and trying to capture him. In the wake of this attack, Kenyan police, recognizing his importance to the lucrative trade, acquired him a local ID, and his prominent Kenyan relative provided new startup capital. One village became particularly iconic in the late 1970s magendo trade. And today, residents of Chepkube still have considerable excitement about the era. It was a time when Chepkube became famous, attracting opportunists from across the region, and even became the subject of songs and novels, one of which is pictured here. And untold numbers of Ugandans ferried pent-up supplies of coffee across the border, and a trading frenzy offered Kenyans the opportunity for considerable riches. As coffee came from Uganda, new commodities were attracted from Kenya. Merchants brought clothes, pots, beer, whiskey, and more. Residents were flush with cash, leading to tailors sewing special pockets into oversized jackets. One man told me, we would see people coming with bags full of money. You could see someone coming with a huge handbag carrying, what, 10 million shillings in cash. Another resident told me, trying to convey the excitement at the moment, bicycles went up to Chepkube, brand new. The newfound prosperity was due to a particular conjuncture. At the same time that disarray was shaking Uganda under Idi Amin, two failures of the Brazilian coffee crop sent international prices skyrocketing. The unsold beans from Uganda could fetch an extraordinary price, and Kenya's border residents were well placed for mediating the trade. So in this sense, coffee smuggling was a type of arbitrage. While traditionally considered the reserve of high finance, I think of arbitrage more generally as the capitalization on difference. Now, most frequently, this is due to price differentials between market jurisdictions, but these differences can also be temporal and in the type of evaluative principles used to assess goods. Nor is the difference given a priori. Rather, arbitragers actively cultivate difference in order to capitalize on it. So for instance, margins could be made in the Magendo trade through misrepresentation and deceit, as I'll discuss below. Or one could remake chronologies in order to produce a margin. Residents of the Kenya-Uganda borderlands experience these practices as morally fraught. And indeed, arbitrage is particularly prone to generate social instability and ethical quandaries. So to succeed in arbitrage, relatively stable assumptions and background conditions that ground social relations become matters of concern, liable to change, fluctuation, even collapse. What valuation practices are monopolized fragment, as putative equilibria are shown to be mere convention. Yet the capacity to manipulate these evaluative schema or to remake space-time, it's not evenly distributed. And so the result is that the rewards of arbitrage often lead to an unsettling of received notions and mores about the appropriate acquisition and distribution of wealth. These assessments are rarely uniform, leading to a kind of ambiguous mixture of desire and disdain. But it's worth emphasizing here that the ethical ambiguity isn't about the illegality of the trade. Rather, it's because Magendo challenges people's ideas about the temporality of wealth, about gendered and generational hierarchies, and about the relationship between surface and substance. Magendo provided, in other words, value that was unsanctioned by the prevailing social hierarchies in Bukusu society. What does that look like in practice? So the movement of coffee between territorial jurisdictions from Uganda to Kenya was the fundamental form of arbitrage during Magendo. Josiah is emblematic of this, but other more subtle forms of difference were cultivated and crossed by participants. So these sought to maneuver between different evaluative standards or to manage the relationship between surface appearance and the enduring quality of a coffee bean. So take the example of measuring coffee for sale. I discussed earlier the state's official metrology for cash crops. They were sorted and weighed by particular standards. Coffee was assigned a certain price, but Magendo got rid of all this, instead moving between accounting by volume, by weight, and by Kenya shillings. How did this work? Ugandans would arrive in Kenya with partially filled bags of coffee, right? Depending on how much they could carry, how much they had grown and stored. Kenyans would be waiting to meet them at the Malaba River. Coffee beans were scooped from Ugandans' half-filled bags and deposited into the buyer's bags. The humble implement for scooping coffee is known as the gorogoro and is pictured here. Kenyans will tell you that a gorogoro is a 2-kilogram tin, usually repurposed from its original use as a container for store-bought cooking fats. Like the commodity it once held, the gorogoro is standardized, providing a shared marketplace metric. In everyday speech, the standard is 2 kilograms, a figure arising from the original label of 2 kilograms, 2 kg of cooking fat. But however, the commonality of an empty gorogoro, like those pictured here, that commonality is not weight, it's not kilograms. After all, the density of coffee or maize or whatever you're filling the gorogoro with is different than that of cooking fat. Instead, the gorogoro provides a uniform standard of volume. So while Chepkube's residents routinely referred to 2 kilograms of coffee as measured by the gorogoro, this wasn't a reference to weight. Rather, it's to a standardized unit of volume. But the presumed correspondence between weight and volume matters because the interplay between these measurement scales provided a subtle form of arbitrage. Ugandans were paid per gorogoro of coffee, with the tool standardizing the variable amounts of beans brought from Uganda as it was scooped from their bags. The gorogoro therefore serves as what Geyer has called a tropic point, commensurating between the volumetric scale and the different scale of accounting, namely Kenya shillings, in which they were paid. But the gorogoro could also detect impurities. So participants would reenact for me how they would hold the container at eye level and pour the beans out slowly into their own bags, looking for rocks, for fruit, for sand, for other less valuable fillers. Exporters from Nairobi or Mombasa who were buying from the frontier didn't match this kind of discerning caution of the locals. When they arrived in Chepkube, they had large trucks and they didn't measure in gorogoros. Rather, they purchased sacks of coffee by the dozen, full closed sacks. So Chepkube's residents would laugh, they'd have this wry smile when they explained to me the funny tricks that they would use to fill this space with rocks. By the time such a deception was discovered in Nairobi or Mombasa, it was hardly worth the time to follow up. In some cases, precaution was taken. Over time, some gravity scales from which a gunny sack of coffee could be hung and weighed, those arrived in Chepkube, allowing buyers from elsewhere to pay per kilogram rather than per gunny sack. But local arbitragers developed new tactics to produce a difference, most notably through soaking dry coffee beans in water overnight in the Malaba River to bulk them. And then the plumper beans would receive just a cursory drying in the morning sun of only their exterior. And in these cases, the density of coffee and to a lesser degree its volume again became a variable as surface level dehydration could conceal the moistened coffee within. The presumed material fixity of a dry coffee bean was transformed into a plasticity subject to manipulation. Now the aim of all these kind of scalar technicalities and maneuvers was to insert or detect a small difference, the type of thing capitalized in arbitrage. Now, throughout my fieldwork, laughter accompanied the stories of this trade. I think this laughter subtly acknowledged the unequal opportunism of the moment. It served to hold together contradictions, namely that the attractiveness of unbridled margins existed alongside a recognition that others received the short end of exchange. Laughter represented a sort of admission, not so much of guilt, but as immoderation of excess and the ethical ambiguities surrounding them. The disquiet of the period was the result of a transformation in the accessibility of wealth, and in turn, an erosion of the forms of authority and behavior through which ethical life was to be ordered. An undisciplined binge economy replaced the perceived orderly arrangement between men and women, seniors and juniors, production and consumption. The idioms and tropes through which this was expressed reveal a sense of peril regarding the Magendo era. But such an unease is never far from its cause, namely the enthusiastic embrace of Magendo's opportunities. Thus, memories of the period are ambiguous, with contradictions held together by ironic laughter. Now, binge economies can occur for many reasons, say the discovery of a new export or a speculative frenzy. But around Mount Elgon in Chepkube, it was arbitrage that formed the basis for dramatic accrual and dissipation of wealth. Arbitrage allowed participants to capture and redirect value in unprecedented ways. One way was through competitive gift giving, which displayed one's detachment from money in the pursuit of new social relations. So as one man told me, people were very generous, a lot of drinking, but bars opened from nowhere. They would say, okay, I have a lot of money. I want to buy you a beer, my friend. Stand up. And you'd stand up. And I would pile crates of beer up to your height, and that was yours. Now, such consumptive possibilities are remembered with relish, but they also manifest an unsettled order of age, of gender, and of rank. Throughout East Africa, alcohol, meat, these are symbolically charged goods. Bukusu men historically demonstrated their worth through the quality of their home-brewed beer and their generosity in its distribution. Only elderly men and sometimes women could enjoy beer drinking as a regular pastime. Younger folks only enjoyed it at special events or as a reward for labor. These restrictions on consumption and attempts to subvert them are constitutive of the claims to authority by senior men. Notions and practices of drinking are therefore practical enactments of hierarchical and exclusive social relations. Transformations in access, such as those described by my interviewee, can unsettle the norms of respect and power. In the case of Magendo, such new consumptive possibilities were part of a more general disordering. For instance, temporality was also upended. Binge economies, as Richard Wilk has written, are characterized by their presentism. The immediacy with which wealth is available militates against all other activities. There's no time to spare. So big buyers coming from afar would rent hotel rooms in the closest urban center of Bungoma and further south. Others just broke some branches for a makeshift camp, slept in the bushes to buy the coffee. Such an arrangement belies the weight that Bukusu communities have historically given to a proper home, seeing deficient housing as a sign of indolence. Yet during the coffee boom, no attention was given to such basic concerns. Walking one day near the river that divides the two countries, a friend stopped and pointed. He said, it was like a refugee camp here. Government ministers and their wives, even Margaret Kenyatta, I was assured, turned to such rudimentary quarters. Naively assuming that the former mayor of Nairobi, the daughter of the country's founding president, could afford it, I said, why didn't she just have a house built here? And the answer was immediate, followed by hearty laughter at the incongruous, even carnivalesque logic of the time. Who's going to build it? Where are you going to get the labor? The velocity of value also accelerated. Some big buyers received substantial advances from banks, permitting them to turn a larger profit. I was told of a government official and confidant of the president whose wife spent time at Chepkube. This minister used his position to get all the cash from the main bank branch in Bungoma. People needed to buy coffee at Chepkube, I was told, so even the bank ran out of cash, failing to pay teachers that month because of it. The Nairobi headquarters had to airlift cash in to ameliorate the shortage. Other well-connected individuals and buyers turned to cooperative agricultural societies, using that collectively held cash as an advance to purchase Magendo coffee. In both these stories, it's collective futures, children's education in the case of teachers, the farmer cooperation in the case of the co-ops, that are mortgaged for immediate gains. Amid the dramatic consumption of the period, few invested in productive assets. People were busy, one former teacher told me. Even our own coffee farms, we couldn't manage them because people were interested in getting easy money, quick money. Only a few managed their own farms. In his reckoning, meaningful value was durable, and it took time and sweat to accumulate. Only over time was it possible to gain the value that was born through the experience and productivity of discipline. This required converting quicker money into more enduring forms of value, such as land, something Sybil Kusimba has recently written about. Wealth out of time, that is, money realized through the normal prerequisites of self-restraint and, importantly, collective effort, wealth out of time was likely to run out in no time. The exigencies that characterize Magendo upended existing temporal rhythms. There was a quickening of the extended schedule through which the life course historically unfolded, as well as a narrowing of the social relations that were necessary to uphold them. So for example, the regulatory function of marriage, through which individuals enter into a more senior social role and through which property is redistributed across generations and between families. This regulatory function of marriage was tested by arbitrage. As Peter, a neighbor of my host, put it to me, Magendo was spoiling people, particularly the younger generation. Marriage was a problem. Someone could marry five wives because he had the money then, yet he couldn't support all of them when Magendo ended. Ritual time accelerated, and with it, the stature achieved through maturity was debased. Whereas the sequencing of marriage, including the transfer of 13 cattle, was typically drawn out over a longer period, newly enriched men could skip such time. The performance of ongoing entrustment signaled by the non-repayment of debt was cut short, suggesting impertinence. Another index of declining gerontocratic power was the involvement of children in the Magendo trade. My interlocutors explained how children stopped attending school to pick up fallen beans in the marketplace, selling them when they themselves filled a gorogoro with the remainder from others' trade. With their money, they could acquire the material trappings well beyond their age. They even bought shoes, told me one man who remains scandalized by the memory 40 years later. For senior men, the situation was disconcerting, even existentially threatening. There was no respect because everyone was rich by that time, said one former subchief. No respect for whom, I clarified. For elders. If you have a children having, I mean, more than, let me say, more than 1,000 shillings, and you have no money as an elder, he overlooks you. What do you do for him? He can even buy you. The broad accessibility of the trade and its resulting wealth undermined the hierarchies through which juniors and seniors related, through which value was apportioned and ethics practiced. In the views of senior men, uncontrolled access to money permitted their social juniors to bypass not only proper authority, but the patient cultivation of responsibility. The most dramatic incident of the Magendo period, indeed its denouement in the view of some, arose from the realization that counterfeit Kenya shillings were being used to buy coffee. This was uniformly blamed on Somali exporters, leading to a day-long conflagration and multiple deaths. Kenyan police didn't arrive for hours, but in their place, the very same gerontocratic authority, sidelined by Magendo, restored order. The story was initially told to me while drinking soda overlooking the border river. The center of the fighting was here, I was told by Meshach. He remembered two people who tried to stop the fighting, his late father and the late Ronald Mukhebi. These ones, they carried spears, he explained, and at this point he held a kind of stoic resolve as he mimicked the act of holding a spear above his head, pointing straight up. They were not scared by the stones being thrown in the middle, and so it stopped. And when the police came, everything was under control. Meshach's age mate sitting near me chimed in. He explained that these were highly respected elders, and they were the ones who kept the peace. But for others, it was not counterfeit money nor the enfeebled local gerontocracy that ended Magendo. Rather, it was the paternal authority of what Paul Okobok has called the elder state that was required to bring arbitrage to heel. Some residents of Chepkube recall the death of President Jomo Kenyatta and the assumption of Daniel Arap Moi as the change that ended the trade. If Kenyatta could still be on the throne, someone told me, I think things would continue because his family, they were the ones buying coffee with the trucks. Now, nationally in Kenya, Jomo Kenyatta and his family are remembered as acquisitive, even indulgent. This permissiveness is subtly contrasted with his successor, Daniel Arap Moi, a well-known teetotaler and churchgoer untempted by earthly pleasures. By the time Moi was sidelined or forced aside in 2002 after 24 years in power, he had solidified a reputation for authoritarian control that frontier residents told me was presaged in his closure of arbitrage. For my interlocutors, Moy's rectitude in moral matters is juxtaposed with the ethical ambiguities of Magendo. The austerity of this famous arbiter of order stands against the exuberance of the period. It is his rule that served to curtail drunkenness, school leaving, and the disrespect for elders associated with Magendo. But in closing, I want to emphasize that these contradictory feelings It's not merely that there was a kind of uniform search for gerontocratic state that regulates the scales at which valuation occurs, but there's also an attraction to the opportunities for the subversion of that. So if the petitions by citizens that I discussed in part one display a sort of desire for an economic sovereign, the coffee Magendo that I discussed in part two suggests an escape from those very same protocols. But these are not, at least in, I think, the perspective of my interlocutors or what's reflected in the archive, alternatives. Rather, they're more like simultaneous parts of a shared repertoire for the making and remaking of valued lives. Thanks very much. Look forward to your thoughts.